Will you be my friend today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's getting ready to meet Russia's Vladimir Putin. He's not my enemy, says Trump. Maybe we'll be friends. But is Putin on board?
Vladimir Putin has always given Trump a little bit of leeway, I would say, even as we've watched U.S.-Russian relations dip.
Well, Trump definitely has some friends in Ramsgate, England.
It's a refreshing change when someone comes along and actually says what he means, does what he wants to do, and rattles a few cages along the way, doesn't he?
And is phasing out plastic straws a big ecological victory or just a feel-good gesture?
This idea relates more to the psychology of moral bookkeeping.
Who knew a straw could carry such ethical weight? Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Very glad you could make it here today. President Trump is bouncing around Europe. He wrapped up a tense NATO summit in Brussels this morning, then moved on to Britain for the start of a three-day visit there. Lots of anti-Trump protests planned for London and elsewhere, but as we'll hear later in the show, the president also enjoys some support in the UK. We begin, though, with a fast-forward to Monday, when Trump is scheduled to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. That's happening in Finland's capital, Helsinki. And we're hearing that the two leaders are planning to meet, at least initially, without staffers in the room, just their interpreters, which for us raises a few questions. Charles Maines is in Moscow. Will there be any official record of this initial one-on-one, Charles?
Well, it doesn't appear so. They'll meet with their translators. Vladimir Putin does speak some English, but not particularly well. They'll have a little time to kind of warm up, get to know each other a little bit better. Of course, these two leaders have met before at the G20, also at the Asia-Pacific summit. But, you know, this is a chance, they say, for just to kind of break the ice before everyone comes in and joins them for the serious talks.
So what risks are there diplomatically having this one-on-one?
Well, I think that the risk here is that Trump gives away something to Putin. Putin's obviously a much more experienced politician, although Trump, of course, likes to fashion himself as a master negotiator, you know, the art of the deal and all that. But Putin's now on his fourth U.S. president in terms of negotiations for these kind of things. Mm. So I think the sense is that Putin could run the table with Trump in just a little while. But, you know, of course, there are his advisors coming in, and that does bring some balance to things no matter what happens there.
Trump has said he views Putin as a competitor. He's also said he's not my enemy. Maybe we'll be friends. Do we know how Putin views Trump?
Well, you know, Vladimir Putin famously called Trump colorful during the presidential campaign. Trump then interpreted that as Putin calling him a genius, which wasn't true. But basically, you know, Vladimir Putin has always given Trump a little bit of leeway, I would say, even as we've watched U.S.-Russian relations dip lower and lower over the past year. Of course, there have been sanctions, there have been diplomatic expulsions, and all these, of course, differences over Ukraine, over Syria. But at the same time, Putin certainly, and most of the Kremlin, I think they view Trump as the only person in Washington at this point who seems to profess anyway to want better relations with Russia and better relations with Vladimir Putin.
So Trump has apparently a laundry list of things he wants to discuss. He'll have just come out of a fairly public dismissal of NATO and says that the U.S. will go it alone if NATO members don't increase spending by January of 2019. There is, of course, a Russia's interference with the U.S. election that's on the agenda. But how likely is it that any or all of these things will come up with Putin?
Well, it's interesting. This summit is really a shotgun summit. I mean, it was cast in the wake of the Kim Jong-un summit in Singapore. Trump obviously felt that that went well and that negotiating one-on-one with leaders was effective for him. So, you know, in a way, they've been said all along that they were going to discuss everything. And yet the sense from talking to people here in Moscow is that they're going to talk about nothing. This is more about optics rather than outcomes. You know, it's also interesting for me to see how Trump's critics, both in the U.S. and in Europe, you know, they go berserk when they see Trump tweet about issues that seem to throw a lifeline to Vladimir Putin, whether we're talking about reintroducing Russia to the G7 or providing sanctions relief. The Russians tend to ignore this stuff. And to give you an idea, I met up with Maria Lipman. She's the editor of Counterpoint magazine here in Moscow. And she says that, you know, Russia has learned to kind of take all these statements by Trump with a grain of salt, although she uses a Russian expression that sounds slightly different.
In Russian, we have this expression, a tongue without bones, meaning that anything can be said, but there is sometimes a very long distance between words and deeds.
So, Charles, what does Putin hope to get out of this meeting, and what will he actually get out of it?
Well, you know, it's not that the Russians don't have a laundry list of things that they would love to get. It's just that they recognize that none of them are realistic. So basically, they've come down to this understanding that this is all about optics. And in this sense, it is successful in Russia in its own way, because it shows Russia's back as this kind of global player on the stage. You know, it's very central, I think, to what Putin's ideas over the last decade have been, which is that it's not a monopolar world where the U.S. gets to dictate everything, but it's a multipolar world, and Russia is a key player not to be ignored. And even if you look at the site of this summit, Helsinki, Finland, this is a place with historic overtones. This is where Cold War adversaries faced off. And this is why Trump likes it, because of the historical kind of overtones. At the same time, Vladimir Putin likes it, because it also harkens back to this day when it's the U.S. and Russia, or the Soviet Union at that time, essentially determining the fate of the world.
Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much for raising the curtain on this little gathering between Putin and Trump. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
It won't be the first time leaders from Washington and Moscow meet in Finland's capital, Helsinki. For example, President George H.W. Bush met Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev there in 1990. Our next story also harkens back to the Soviet era. It's about a Twitter account called Soviet Visuals. It specializes in the sort of images that, for some people, evoke a certain kind of Cold War nostalgia. We're talking a steady stream of videos and photos that capture some aspects, sometimes pretty surreal aspects, of Soviet life. The account now has more than 100,000 followers. It was created by Moscow native Varya Bortsova. So you'd been a dancer with the Moscow City Ballet, and then you were working in tech in Singapore. What inspired you to start this Twitter account?
So it really comes down to the fact that I was born in the Soviet Union, I'd say. It fell apart soon after, and I swear that my birth has nothing to do with this.
Yeah, but you were like a year old when the Soviet Union collapsed.
I was a year old, exactly. Anyway, so these visuals, they were always kind of embedded into my childhood, the shows I saw on television, the stories I heard at home. So back then, they just seemed ordinary to me. But when I grew up and traveled out of Russia, I looked back at some of it with new eyes. And in these things that I used to find mundane before, I started seeing humor and absurdity and beauty and some great entertainment value. So I'd share some of these memories and footage with a couple of my friends from other countries. And for them, it was a whole new world, because they never really saw that part of it. They had a good grasp of the history and geography, things they learned in school, but they definitely weren't aware of like Soviet TV commercials or funky amateur pop bands from the Chelyabinsk, you know, pipe rolling factory. So I started digging some more, and then decided to create a Twitter account to kind of consolidate these makeshift archives. Well, so that's how it happened.
You have certainly dredged up some serious entertainment value. I mean, it's kind of like a kitschy rabbit hole once you start. I mean, there are a lot of campy treasures here, like a video of the outdoor disco party from 1989. It's been retweeted actually more than 1,800 times, and you can see why, with these super 80s style outfits and pretty awkward dance moves. There's also a corn commercial with a chef singing opera and food dancing around the kitchen. Tell us about that one. This is a commercial, right?
That was one of the highlights for me as I was discovering this stuff. It's a TV commercial, yes. If I remember correctly, it was the first Soviet TV commercial, and it came out in the early 60s when Soviet leadership decided to popularize corn as this sort of miracle crop. And it's just the best thing ever. It's basically a two-minute musical where corn has the leading role, dancing around, singing about how much it wants to be on the menu. And this video, it's actually part of a whole series of corn media. So there are books, there's a corn dance performance, there are animated series.
I mean, I shouldn't laugh. I mean, I come from the country where we've got a singing Alka-Seltzer tab. So in 2 years, you've tweeted more than 11,000 times this stuff. Where do you find all this content?
Everywhere. I look through family photo albums, through open source libraries, old books, magazines. My parents have become a huge source of interesting content. My grandma sends things in. Whenever I travel back to Russia or any of the post-Soviet countries, it becomes this like sourcing adventure. The one thing to note, though, is if before I was responsible for finding and posting most of the stuff, now I have people from all over the world sharing visuals with me and sending in videos and their own stories. So it evolved into this community where it's now a bunch of people just using it as a platform to share instead of just me pushing it out.
And your followers and your contributors, are they kind of like you, people who were infants or not even born in the Soviet era?
So some are expats from these post-Soviet countries. Others are journalists and professors and filmmakers.
I mean, I'm still kind of gobsmacked by the surreal Ukrainian commercial for chicken schnitzel with these sequined disco go-go dancers. But, I mean, the site isn't all disco and dancing food. What are some of the themes that you've noticed that keep cropping up?
So the one thing I find super interesting is that whenever I post something, the community will embrace it and find a variety of meanings. People will make references to the current state of things. They'll make connections to their own countries. The space program, I remember I posted at one point an illustration from a Soviet technology magazine, and then someone picked up on it and said, hey, this is Hyperloop. And it actually did look so much like Tesla's Hyperloop mockups, you know, so super interesting.
A lot of these images and videos, they're so kitschy, but I'm wondering, you know, with Putin looking to the past glory of Russia, I mean, you look at some of this stuff and it's like, wow, I'm not sure we can be proud about that, but would I find Russians that would disagree?
So I think the one thing I noticed is that as I do this, I get criticism from kind of both ends of the table. I'll have people who say, hey, you know, you're positioning the Soviet Union in a positive light. And then I'll have the same amount of people saying, hey, you're positioning it in a negative light. So for me, I think it's a good sign because it shows that I'm staying relatively neutral. There are definitely some people who are maybe overly proud or overly critical, but I try to stay away from it, to kind of stick to just the sharing.
So Soviet Visuals also has an online shop, and we see some really beautiful graphic art, both at the shop and on the Twitter account. How do you kind of start to even understand this creativity under what was a fairly repressive regime?
So I think it comes down to maybe working from inside the box. After all of the stuff that I saw as I developed this project, I noticed that when artists and designers and architects are working within a strict series of limits, the products of their work come out as something really interesting. So yes, they did not have the freedom that artists have today. Probably it was not a good thing, but the good side of it is that they did come up with some extremely innovative and interesting things that maybe they wouldn't have come up with had they had this freedom.
What about any images that have especially intrigued you that you've come across?
One, I wouldn't say an image, but one story I came across that I wasn't aware of before is the story of Galina Balashova. She was a Soviet engineer, and she was actually responsible for designing the interiors of spaceships in the early years of the space program. So her designs are just fascinating, and the kind of challenges she had to solve at a time where she didn't have too many points of reference to work with, it's really something. And I don't think anyone actually knew of her until quite recently. So to come across these individuals and their work has been super rewarding for me personally.
Varya Bartsova is curator of the Twitter account Soviet Visuals. It's really fascinating. You should all check it out. Varya, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
And you're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. This week on the show, we're hearing stories from a country we don't often hear from, Paraguay. The world's Rupa Shenoy traveled there for our Across Women's Lives project. And today, she brings us a story about a topic that, until pretty recently, was not discussed much in Paraguay, domestic violence. This is a story about two women who made big sacrifices to help change attitudes in this deeply conservative South American country, including the attitudes of other women. And just a quick warning, there's some sensitive subject matter coming up, maybe not appropriate for everyone.
It took a long time for Andrea Valobra to realize something about her culture. She grew up knowing that women were expected to do certain duties that men didn't have to do, like cleaning and cooking. But she didn't understand the extent of the machismo until she was in her teens. Her first boyfriend raped her. Another hit and choked her.
He likes you, so he will rape you. or he loves you too much, and that's why he will hit you.
That's what the women in her family told her.
Males are like that. They can't control themselves. Like, everyone told me that that was like a, probably like a normal thing. I was like, really? So that marked me my whole life.
We're sitting in an old cafe in Asunción, frequented by poets, film directors, and rock stars like Valobra. She became a star when she was 16, after she appeared on Rojo.
Ryan Rojo!
It's like Paraguay's version of American Idol.
I didn't win. I finished third, but that was a good thing.
Lots of people didn't like the person who came out on top. The audience was outraged that Valobra didn't win. That emotion propelled her career for a decade afterward, until Valobra decided to use her fame to talk about violence against women. She released the song Ella, Her. It describes a woman in a house listening to the sounds of her husband arriving and fearing being beaten by him again.
She knows what's going to happen, but she can't do anything. And then I kind of try to tell that whoever loves you wouldn't do that, so you really have to get out of there. Like, take your freedom, that's all that matters, and just go away, you know?
Valobra says people told her the song was too radical. Radio stations wouldn't play it. People stopped asking her to play gigs. Big brands didn't ask her to endorse them anymore. Valobra says people accused her of demonizing men.
Some people saying, oh my God, why are you doing this? All of us men are going to feel like so bad with this song. Like, come on, we're not like that. You're overreacting.
Her career tanked. And Valobra slowly realized that she'd sacrificed mainstream success by speaking out. But online, her song was a hit. Women wrote Valobra to tell her it gave them courage to report their own abuse.
Many people write to me and come to me and tell me, I thought that I was the only one. Your song changed my life.
Valobra's message to women to stop tolerating abuse came at the same time as a murder trial that captured national attention and drove home the problem that when women do report domestic abuse, police don't always take it seriously. The trial revolved around Lucia Sandoval, a young mother of two who was beaten by her husband. And like Valobra, Sandoval says her mother told her she just had to live with it because that's how men are.
Si quieres ser una señora que tenés que perdonar, tolerar todo. Por más que siempre va a haber detractores y todo eso, porque acá sabemos que en nuestro país, acá Paraguay, es...
If you want to be a lady, you have to forgive and tolerate everything. More than anything else, Paraguay is very Catholic, so there are things that are misunderstood. People believe in the submission of women as something normal. If the church tells you it's normal, it must be.
When the abuse got worse, Sandoval finally got a restraining order against her husband. She says police told her she had to deliver it to him. She did, and they got in a scuffle. Her husband had a gun, and Sandoval says he accidentally shot himself, fatally.
Y prácticamente mis hijos se quedaron sin papá y sin mamá en un mismo momento.
My children ended up without a father or a mother in the same moment, and that was very hard because I had never been away from them before.
Eventually, Sandoval got a really lucky break. Human rights advocacy group Amnesty International got involved in her case.
Entonces, muchísima gente, la ciudadanía, es como que se solidarizó y se colocó en el lugar. Y es como que puso una discusión.
Many concerned citizens showed empathy and put a discussion into public discourse. Because people didn't dare to talk about domestic abuse, it had always been considered as something private that needs to be dealt with at home and should be more or less hidden.
The attention forced prosecutors to admit evidence that showed Sandoval didn't have gunpowder residue on her after her husband's death, so she couldn't have shot him. When Sandoval was finally acquitted and freed, it was big news.
Tanta gente me ayudó y me apoyó, pues yo también algo tengo que hacer, ¿verdad?
So many people supported me and helped me. I also need to give back. Now I argue, call out, and try to make things better.
Sandoval responded to every interview request and stayed in the public eye. She's become a prominent advocate and lawyer for other domestic violence victims.
Antes no podía pintarme de rojo.
And she wears red nail polish because her husband never let her. He said it was a color for prostitutes. And now I have like 20 shades of red. I love it. Now I paint my nails whenever I want. Valobra, the rock star, says there's been a dramatic change in Paraguay since Sandoval's case and since she released the song Ella. People are willing to talk about domestic violence. More women seem to believe that abuse is wrong. More of them are willing to join public demonstrations. And some important laws have been passed that increased protections for women.
So I was in the beginning of this, you know, because now everybody is doing it and everybody's talking about it. And I've seen videos of girls telling their stories and encourage to other people to tell your story and get out of there. We're all going to support you even though we don't know each other, because that's what we're supposed to do. And it's great to know that somehow I was part of it.
Valobra is married now with a son. She lives with her parents because she says that's what's expected of Paraguayan daughters, even rock stars. And she just released a dance song that returns to the theme of women's rights, but is less confrontational and more palatable than the Ella song, she says.
It's camouflaging a very good way for people to say, oh my God, why are you talking about this again? You know, I wore the lyrics very well, so it doesn't sound like too strong.
It's Valobra's attempt to go back into the mainstream and her way of testing just how much Paraguayans have changed. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Asunción.
I'm Marco Werman. 20 years ago, war shut down communications between Ethiopia and its neighbor Eritrea. Now that there's peace between the two countries, the phone lines work, and some people just want to call and say hello.
I just Googled hotels in Asmara, and then I got a number randomly, and then just called.
That story still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The United Kingdom is playing host to President Trump for the next 3 days. It's Trump's first visit to the UK as president, and he's getting quite the reception, everything from a meeting with the Queen to some pretty sizable protests. The World's Matthew Bell is in London to cover this presidential visit. So what is on the schedule, Matthew?
There's a lot on the schedule. It's actually a working visit, not a full-blown state visit. When the issue came up months ago, there was a big debate here in the UK with a lot of people saying they didn't want Donald Trump to come at all. And then some lawmakers said, well, of course, we're going to have him. He's the president of the United States. And the prime minister made it a working visit. So they're going to be there's going to be a big meeting tonight with business leaders at Winston Churchill's ancestral home. There will be a meeting with Prime Minister Theresa May at the prime minister's country residence. That's a place called Chequers. And then Donald Trump is going to have tea, as you mentioned, with the Queen at Windsor Castle. All of these places, Marco, are outside of London, but sort of accessible, easily accessible from London.
Right. And that's kind of crucial because Trump is not expected to be much at all in London itself. What's going on in London?
Absolutely. That's a very deliberate decision. There are big protests here planned, Marco, for tomorrow. Some protesting has already started today, but Friday is the big day of protest here in central London. There are many thousands of people expected to turn out. Something like 4,000 British police officers are on duty. They've been told they can't take leave for this weekend because they're going to be needed for these protests. The truth is that Donald Trump, if you look at opinion polls, is not widely popular in the UK. There was sort of a stunt, Marco, here where there's been a campaign here for people to download the song American Idiot by Green Day. The song is years old, but it's been for the past few days climbing the charts just because people have been downloading it. Of course, we've also talked to on the show with the organizers of this Trump baby blimp, which has gotten a lot of coverage.
Right.
And that is expected to be flying in the skies of London tomorrow.
Right. So that's London. But Trump has his fans in the UK, right?
Absolutely. He absolutely does. Apparently, Trump might meet with the former Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, who actually just recently quit the government. But I talked to some other fans yesterday. I went out to a town called Ramsgate. It's out in Kent. It's right on the southeast coast of England. It's about a 90-minute train ride from London. It's actually one of the closest places you can be in the UK to France, which is just like 20-something miles across the English Channel. It's a lovely town. The economy there has struggled, though, and partly as a result of that, conservative anti-establishment politicians have done very well politically there in recent years. It did not take me long to find Trump supporters. One of them is a guy named Greg Hale. I talked to him in a pub in central Ramsgate.
The population of London is nowhere near representative of the rest of the country, really, to be honest.
When you talk to people in Ramsgate, they're more receptive to Trump?
No, they are, yeah, definitely. And more out on coastal places and everything, where they've basically just had enough of the whole political scene. And sometimes it makes a refreshing change when someone comes along and actually says what he means, does what he wants to do, and rattles a few cages along the way, doesn't he?
Marco, another person I talked to was the mayor of Ramsgate. His name is Trevor Shonk. He was born and raised in the town. He showed up to meet me in a Union Jack, a British flag necktie. He told me that he shouldn't really be talking about politics, but he kind of couldn't help himself because he's very excited about Donald Trump. He's also very excited about Brexit, and that is the plan to leave the European Union. Here's some of what Mayor Shonk had to tell me.
For 1,000 years, this country looked after its own affairs until the EU, dreaded EU. This is my own personal opinion. The EU become a monster, really, because it's become too big, uncontrollable, not just for this country, for all. And this is why they're going to make sure that we have a hard Brexit, because they don't want any other country to leave. We will leave. We will show the world that we can survive. You've got to wake up and smell the coffee. I mean, we've done it before. We still do it today. We freed Europe. Why be controlled by it?
And finally, Matthew, we've got to make note of the fact that Trump arrives in England at a time of great mourning. England yesterday eliminated from the World Cup in a semifinal match against Croatia. How has that colored everything?
Yeah, that's been a huge story, Marco. There was all kinds of hope for the England team to win yesterday and go to the finals. The last time England won the World Cup was 1966. Obviously, people love their football here. It's funny that England fans are kind of famous for their doomsday attitude. And what I've seen even after the loss is sort of people spinning it in a way to say, look, the team is young. They went farther than we thought they would. And it was kind of a unifying point at a time when politics are quite crazy here, and the team really seemed to bring people together.
Keeping hope alive for 2022, the world's Matthew Bell in London. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Naturally, a very different reaction to yesterday's World Cup semifinal over in Croatia.
We heard the fireworks outside, and when I drove home, I've seen a lot of very excited, crazy people running around, half naked and cheering.
That's Ivan Sersan, a Croatian writer and translator. This is the first time Croatia has made it to the final of the Men's World Cup, so it's a huge source of joy for a country that hasn't had much to celebrate since the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. Sersan says the violence had a lasting impact on nearly everyone in Croatia, including Luka Modric, the captain of the national soccer team.
At the time when he started his football practices, he had to move with his family from his house. And for several years, his family lived as refugees with no permanent home. It's a common thing among the generation that was growing up with the war. people losing members of their families, don't know where they are, or one member of the family went to one country and the other member of the family escaped to another country. So this is a big tragedy that for those who directly pass through it, it's something that always lingers with them, that never goes away from their memory. But it also affected the collective mind and the collective spirit of the societies here. Yugoslavia had a long tradition of really good football players, and all the countries that became independent in the 90s still have very good soccer teams. So the tradition of big football players is being carried from generation to generation. You hear stories about your parents and grandparents watching or listening to the games over the radio. So it's a widespread thing. Football is part of the Balkan culture.
Did the win yesterday against England, did it feel like it was bigger than football? I mean, what did it mean to you?
Whenever these kinds of big sports successes happen in Croatia or in any small country in the world, then majority of people feel very excited and very happy without being actually able to pinpoint what is this happiness about. But it's like some kind of new space is opening and new hope for the better future. These big celebrations are resembling some kind of a new start.
So you obviously know, as a writer, there's a tendency to fuse the narrative on the field with the history and culture of the nations that are playing. And so much has been made of the French team's players who grew up in the tough suburbs and public housing of Paris. Are you looking at Sunday's match against France as a kind of contest between two teams that grew up with social upheaval?
It's a good comparison. Definitely, this will be a highly motivated match between the players that really come from the similar background. There's a great French writer, pen named Goz, who wrote a beautiful book. The book has been translated to Croatian recently, and he came to Croatia to one book festival. He was born in Ivory Coast, and he said, "Hello, Croatians, my brothers," because he explained that the position of the Balkans today and the position of sub-Saharan Africans in Europe today is quite similar.
Well, I wish the Croatian team all the best, though I'm taking note of the fact that you just quoted a French writer. So we'll leave it there, Ivan. Ivan Sirsin, a Croatian writer and translator, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Straws are suddenly having their moment, but not in a good way. Single-use plastic straws are very much the ecological villains right now, and Starbucks is the latest big company to announce it's doing away with them. The world's largest beverage chain says it will be phasing plastic straws out worldwide by 2020. Now, some see this as a big victory for the environment, but is it really? From our Livable Planet desk, here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Just how big of a waste problem are plastic straws?
In 2017, we collected over 600,000 straws off the beach.
That's just in one day, collected on beaches around the world by volunteers during the Ocean Conservancy's annual cleanup. Emily Woglum with the Conservancy says straws aren't really recyclable.
They're small. It's easy for them to leak out of the waste management system, and so they often escape into the ocean. And once they're in the ocean, you know, they last forever. They float. It's easy for that to interact with wildlife like turtles.
Do a web search on sea turtle and straw video, and you'll never look at a plastic straw the same way again. Marine biologists painfully extract a long straw from a bleeding turtle's nostril. Woglum says when she found out about Starbucks' commitment this week, which the company estimates will eliminate 1 billion straws a year, she was, quote, thrilled, but with a caveat.
As long as this is a first step, I think it's a step that's worth celebrating. But it absolutely needs to be the beginning of a journey, not the end.
Starbucks is but one company phasing out but one product. The overall problem of plastic in the ocean remains massive. An estimated 8 million tons of it gets into the sea each year.
That is the equivalent of one city garbage truck per minute, every minute of every day. So that's a lot of plastic going into the ocean.
And straws are about 4% of that. But Woglum says getting rid of straws is something we can feel empowered to do something about right now.
Most of us suck. Most of us suck every day. Suck, suck, suck.
The anti-straw movement has caught on in Hollywood with the celebrity-driven Stop Sucking campaign.
500 million plastic straws are used in this country
every single day.
day.
And many
campaigns like this are working. A handful of cities, including Seattle and a bunch in California, recently banned plastic straws. Soon, you won't be able to get one in Taiwan, on an Alaska Airlines flight, or at a McDonald's in the UK or Ireland. Environmentalists say it'll take governments, consumers, and companies all working on the issue. And one sure way to push companies in that direction is to show that there are viable alternatives. At Alden and Harlow in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they serve modern American food prepared tapas style and drinks with a stainless steel straw. Daniel Pontius is the restaurant's beverage director.
You know, once you start crunching the numbers for something that you use every day in a high-volume restaurant, it gets to be pretty alarming. So we look upwards of 100,000 plastic straws a year we would go through.
He says customers prefer the new metal straws. I did. They stay cold and don't have a plasticky taste. Still, switching to stainless steel brings some hassles.
Yeah, we had to get pipe cleaners because you want to make sure that no debris gets caught in there.
Every straw gets cleaned by hand twice. That's about 30 seconds per straw times several hundred customers. It adds up. Still, in a matter of weeks, that elbow grease can save a restaurant some money.
Metal straws are about 40 cents a piece.
And how much does a plastic straw cost?
Like 3 cents a piece, something like that.
But the motivation to change wasn't financial. Jen Fields is the restaurant's director of operations. It was her idea to ditch the plastic straws.
I think that in the restaurant industry, you don't get a lot of opportunities to have a ton of real impact on the community and the world. I think so. The idea of making a change that would potentially maybe influence other restaurants in the community.
It felt good. And one small step can lead to others.
There's this question about what happens when you do one behavior that's good for the environment. When you do that, what happens to your likelihood of doing future pro-environmental behaviors?
Heather Barnes Truelove teaches environmental psychology at the University of North Florida.
So humans really don't like to be inconsistent in their beliefs and behaviors. So if you do one pro-environmental behavior, you start to see yourself as an environmentalist, someone who cares about the environment and acts accordingly.
But things could go the other way. When we're feeling good about our behavior, we can become complacent.
So then when we have a chance to do another behavior, we sort of say, I already did my part. I just carpooled yesterday. I don't really think I need to, refuse this meat meal today. I can go ahead and indulge and have a hamburger. And so this idea relates more to the psychology of moral bookkeeping.
So getting back to Starbucks' decision to stop using plastic straws, a great first step or meh. Critics are pouncing on Starbucks' announcement, asking, really? Swapping plastic straws for adult sippy cup lids is the best you can do? Starbucks says the new lids will be easier to recycle, and the company is working on other initiatives to reduce its environmental footprint. And at the end of the day, while many vilify companies like Starbucks, it's you and me who are buying their products. Truelove says Starbucks' decision to ditch plastic straws is just a step toward changing consumer behavior.
So it's not just that you're going to have someone go in, they're going to go to Starbucks. Starbucks says, hey, you know, we don't give straws out anymore. And that person has an epiphany and turns around and buys a hybrid on their way home, right? Like, that's too big of a leap, right? So this could be a baby step that sort of helps continue on this path towards bigger and bigger pro-environmental behaviors.
And getting rid of a billion straws a year at Starbucks or even 100,000 at one restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it's not nothing. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
This is monsoon season in parts of South and Southeast Asia. And in Nepal, that doesn't just mean heavy rains. It also means lots of thunder and lightning, which is a serious problem there. Lightning strikes kill more than 100 people in Nepal each year. So this monsoon season, our colleagues with the BBC's Nepali service are trying to help by sharing some common sense tips for staying safe. Rama Parajuli is part of that effort, and she takes the threat seriously because she's been personally affected by lightning strikes twice.
Nepal is in disaster-prone area. Like, earthquake happens here, like, flood happens here, and landslides happen here. And after earthquake, lightning is the one which kills highest number of people. More than 100 people a year. When I was very young, about 9 years old, during monsoon time, the Pandit tells a very emotional, very engaging type of stories from ancient time, maybe the God's story. We call it Puran. It's a Hindu mythology thing. And I used to like to listen to those stories, and I used to go with my grandmother. And when we left the storytelling place, it started raining and I was feeling cold. And my grandmother, in her white shawl, she wrapped me with that white shawl of muslin cloth, the very thin muslin cloth. And I was very near to a tall tree. It's called Kadam in Nepali. Lightning struck this tree's root and some sparks from the tree burned my white shawl with many black holes into it. My grandmother is long dead, but I still remember the incident. I remember my grandmother and the white shawl with black holes, many black holes into it. And I have another encounter or another remembrance from my family. In my maternal grandparents' house, my grandmother was cooking in the third floor of the house. The lightning entered from the top of the house. We could see the marks, the burning, and she was killed. So it was very tragic for me. It was my second encounter with the lightning. I still remember that day again. Nepal is a country of farmers. Many people work in their field during this monsoon and pre-monsoon time. They rely on this monsoon rain. So what we have put in our report is, please don't stay outside when there is lightning. Don't sit under a tree. And if you have to work in the field, do it in the morning, because the lightning occurs especially in afternoon or in the evening. That is how you can protect yourself.
Some common sense tips there on how to avoid being struck by lightning from the BBC's Rama Parajuli in Nepal. Finally today, Ethiopia and Eritrea signed a historic peace deal this week, ending 20 years of conflict between the two nations. The agreement establishes diplomatic ties between Ethiopia and Eritrea. It also opens up all sorts of other links: air travel, trade, even phone services, because for the past two decades, a regular phone call, say, from Addis Ababa to Asmara was impossible. Now some Ethiopians and Eritreans are so stoked about their new phone link that they're randomly calling each other just to say hello. Roman Tafesawork Gomeju is one of these cold callers who reached out to Eritreans from her home in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital. So when you first heard the news, Roman, about this peace agreement between Ethiopia and Eritrea, what went through your head?
I was so excited when I heard the news first, because my father used to live there in Asmara, in capital, for 5 years. I remembered my childhood stories that he told me, how good the food is, how hospitable the people are. I was always dreaming of seeing Asmara once in my lifetime, but I thought it was too far away because of the war. And when I heard the news of the argument between the two nations, I was so excited. You know, my eyes were full of tears, honestly. And then I didn't know what to do. I just don't know anyone there. I don't know the language there. I speak Amharic. You know, I wanted just to talk to someone in Asmara. I just Googled hotels in Asmara, and then I got a number randomly, and I just called.
You called a hotel, and who did you speak to? I mean, as you said, you speak Amharic and they speak Tigrinya. How did you communicate? What did you want to communicate?
So I just said, like, hello, you don't know me. I don't know you. I'm just calling from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. I just wanted to say hi to you all. And she was speaking Tigrinya, but there was a friend of mine next to me. She was translating it for me. And she told me from the other end, they were so happy. They were so excited that I called. The feeling was the same. And they're so happy about the peace agreement between the two nations. And then after a while, there was a guy that came who can speak my language, which is Amharic. And then he said, okay, how do you feel? How is the feeling in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia? I said, we are so excited. And then he asked me, like, okay, what if we come? Will you receive us very well? I said, oh my God, we can't wait to see you. And I can't wait to come to Asmara as well.
So you posted afterwards on Facebook, guess what? I randomly called a hotel in Asmara from the internet just to say hello. That's how crazy happy I am. What response did you get from friends in Addis after you did this?
Oh my God, that was, I didn't expect this. Many of my friends were, I thought that they would say, oh, you're crazy. But they said, oh my God, you inspired us. Let's now call. Give me the number that you called, or how did you start? And what was the response from them? That was all what I heard from my friends.
I mean, your own story is really interesting because it shows that this border separated people with a lot in common. Do you know families in Ethiopia and Eritrea separated by the fighting and the tension?
Oh, so many. I mean, you can hear a lot of stories, like a husband in Eritrea, a wife in Ethiopia, children in Eritrea, the families or the parents in Ethiopia. There are a lot of stories like this, very sad stories, actually.
So how soon are you going to go visit Asmara?
Actually, the first flight to Asmara is going to be next week via Ethiopian Airlines, but I don't think I'm going to do it next week, but for sure, the other week I'll be there.
So much good food, and not to mention cool architecture there. There's a lot for you to discover.
There's a lot for me to discover. You know, the capital is Asmara, you know, the people, the food. There are a lot of things that I think I'll be exploring and getting.
And what about Eritreans who might want to come to Ethiopia? Are you ready to host them?
Oh, definitely, my dear. Everyone is eager here. If you come and see the vibe in Ethiopia, specifically where I live in Addis Ababa, you can't even imagine. So we are all excited and we're ready to host them, of course.
Roman Tefesewerk Gomeju, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Reunited feels so good. That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.